Hello, everybody. It's Tim, one half of Horror Movie Yearbook, here with your daily horror hotline for August 17th, Friday, August 17th, 2018. Hope everybody is having a good week. Hope everybody is ready for the weekend. We have got quite a bit to get to today, so let's jump right into the news. There's just one piece of news that I wanted to cover. The release date for the Halloween official soundtrack has been announced. This has been announced by the folks over at Sacred Bones Studios. It's going to be released on October 19th, the same day as the movie. Here is a little bit from their press release regarding the soundtrack. When the new Halloween movie hits theaters in October 2018, it will have the distinction of being the first film in the canon with creator John Carpenter's direct involvement since 1982's Halloween 3, Season of the Witch. Carpenter serves on the new David Gordon Green directed installment as an executive producer, a creative consultant, and thrillingly as a soundtrack composer alongside its collaborators from his three recent solo albums, Cody Carpenter and Daniel Davies. Those solo albums are excellent, by the way. The new soundtrack pays homage to the classic Halloween score that Carpenter composed and recorded in 1978, when he forever changed the course of horror cinema and synthesizer music with his low-budget masterpiece. Several new versions of the iconic main theme serve as the pulse of Green's film, its familiar 5-4 refrain, stabbing through the soundtrack like the shape's knife. The rest of the soundtrack is just as enthralling, incorporating everything from atmospheric synth whooshes to eerie piano-driven pieces to skittering electronic percussion. While the new score was made with a few more resources than Carpenter's famously shoestring original, its musical spirit was preserved. So we get a little bit, Sacred Bones gives us a little bit into what the soundtrack is going to sound like there, what the score is going to sound like there. They also released some pictures of the vinyl. It looks like there are four or five different variations on the album art. There's some cool stuff over there. Jump over to sacredbones.com to check it out. This would be even cooler than this press release and the release date coming out. They posted a brief teaser for the soundtrack on YouTube. It's really quick. It features a snippet of the score, some kind of ambient noises, and then it leads into a really short version of the Halloween main theme that they will be using. It's our first real listen to the score, so you can check it out over on the Sacred Bones YouTube page. And yeah, once again, the soundtrack is up for pre-order, and you can order it for pre-order. It will be released on October 19th. Let's preview some movies for the weekend. What comes out this weekend, horror-wise? The Ranger. The Ranger is about teen punks on the run. It's from Rotten Tomatoes. Teen punks on the run from the cops and hiding out in the woods face off against the local authority, an unhinged park ranger with an axe to grind. This is directed and written by Jen Wexler. It's in limited theaters now. It's got a runtime of 76 minutes. See, this is written by Jen Wexler. She was a producer and director. She is known for producing the movie Psychopass by Mickey Keating and Darling, which I believe is also a Mickey Keating film. Those just came out in 2015, and Psychopass was last year, 2017. I actually haven't got a chance to check either one of those out. I meant to catch Psychopass, but have not. This premiered back at South By in March. The reviews are pretty good. 8 fresh, 2 rotten last time I checked. Scott Weinberg from Crooked Marquee says, eschewing broad humor for sly wit, director Jen Wexler manages to emulate the slasher classics without ever getting silly about it. That's Scott Weinberg from Crooked Marquee. I watched the trailer for this. It's kind of a cute faux, like, come camp at camp, whatever it is. It's kind of like a cute faux commercial. It's a fun enough trailer. I'm going to sound like a hypocrite because I just, like, blasted Summer of 84 last week about how I'm just kind of tired of homages to 80s movies. But I thought this looked kind of fun, and it's only 74 minutes, and I'm kind of in the mood for a slasher. So this might be the movie I watch this week. The other bigger movie coming out this weekend, Puppet Master, The Littlest Reich, the 13th, I believe, movie in the Puppet Master series. When Edgar decides to sell a nefarious-looking puppet at a convention, All hell breaks loose when the puppets come alive and go on a killing spree. This is directed by Sonny Laguna, Tommy Wicklund, written by S. Craig Zahler. This is in theaters, limited release, but it's also on disc and streaming today. Runtime about 84 minutes. I am no expert on the Puppet Master franchise. Like I said, this is the 13th film. I believe this is a reboot of the Puppet Master timeline. It's insane. I have seen part one, and I have seen Puppet Master versus Demonic Toys. I unfortunately have seen all of the Demonic Toys franchise. You can listen to our Fight the Franchise episode on that. It's in our feed. Go check it out. Horror Movie Yearbook on any of your favorite podcast listening services. So yeah, I'm not necessarily an expert. I think I've only seen like one or two of the Puppet Master movies. I'm not overly excited about this, but what the big draw to this is the talent involved. Written by S. Craig Zahler, who is the writer-director of Bone Tomahawk and Brawl in Cell Block 99, two movies which I really, really liked. And it stars Thomas Lennon from Reno 911, Lieutenant Jim Dangle. He also wrote and directed the horror comedy Hell Babies a few years back, which was kind of funny. It's also got Charlene Yee from Knocked Up and Paper Heart. I really like her. Udo Kier is in this. Barbara Crampton. Okay, now I'm definitely going to watch it. This is also, in addition to the talent, this is also our first look at the kind of the new Fangoria. This is the first movie released by them. We talked a little bit earlier this week or last week. Gosh, it's been so long. We talked a little bit about how they were getting into filmmaking, distributing with the news of Satanic Panic finding its director. And this is the first real example that we're going to see of kind of what they have in store for us filmmaking wise. Reviews right now, or were when I checked late yesterday, were 9 fresh, 3 rotten. A.A. Dowd from the AV Club says, a more mean-spirited and tongue-in-cheek B-movie than its predecessors, closer and proudly politically incorrect spirit to something that East Coast grindhouse rival Troma might vomit out. Once again, that's kind of selling me on it. AV Club did not necessarily like it, but the New York Times loved it. Jeanette Katsuyo says, from the New York Times, says certifiably bonkers and cheerfully offensive. So there you go. Those are the two big ones coming out this weekend. Puppet Master, The Littlest Reich, and The Ranger. I don't know which one I'm going to check out. I will be back with a review of some new release on Tuesday. But yeah, those are the two bigger ones. I'm kind of leaning towards The Ranger right now, to be honest with you. It's shorter. Well, they're both like 70 or 80 minutes, so whatever. So there you go. There's your news and weekend preview. Now I'm going to get into a classic movie. I've been wanting to watch some classics and like, I'm talking like old movies here. We're going to jump back to the class of 1928, The Man Who Laughs. Now, The Man Who Laughs is a 1928 silent film directed by German director Paul Lenny. Lenny is probably best known to horror fans for directing the 1924 film Waxwork, also known in German as Das Waschfigurenkabinett. That was not even close. My fiance speaks German, and she listens to this, she's going to insult me for what I just did. He's either known to horror fans for Waxworks or the 1927 Universal Studios silent adaptation of The Cat and the Canary. Along with directors like Wien, Murnau, and Fritz Lang, Lenny is pointed to as a prime example of German expressionism in film. As Roger Ebert said of him in his review of The Man Who Laughs, he was an art director who grew up in Germany during the era of an expressionism of films dominated by twisted sets and characters, harsh angles, deep shadows, and careening staircases. The Man Who Laughs stars Conrad Veidt as the titular Man Who Laughs, aka Gwynplaine. Veidt is probably best remembered by horror fans, or for me at least, for his part in the 1920 Robert Vine version of The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, one of my favorite early horror films, and probably one of the more important early horror films. Veidt plays Cesar, a somnambulist who is hypnotized by a complete maniac named Dr. Caligari. Cesar is forced to do Caligari's bidding by committing murder in a village in Germany. Honestly, Dr. Caligari is probably the much better example of German expressionist horror film, but I've seen it like a bunch of times, so I decided to watch The Man Who Laughs instead. Even though the film isn't necessarily a horror film, its influences can be seen on a ton of later horror works that followed. For example, Rob Zombie has named the film as a major influence, calling it one of his favorite silent films of all time. He even had a song on his fourth album, Hellbilly Deluxe, called The Man Who Laughs. It's like an 11-minute song. Rob really likes it, apparently. The Man Who Laughs is based on a novel by Victor Hugo, L'Homme qui Rit, that's not even close either. But don't worry, I am taking Duolingo French, so I should be fluent in it in no time. So if another French term or French novel comes up, I will be able to pronounce it 100%. Hugo, of course, is the French writer of Les Mis and The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Speaking of pronunciation, I'm one of those people who refers to it as Les Mis because I can't pronounce the actual title. The novel was published in 1869 and was one of Hugo's lesser successful works. Here is the plot of the film adaptation, which was released in 1928. And thank you, Rotten Tomatoes, for this, by the way. The story concerns Gwynplaine, the son of an enemy of the evil king. Putting Gwynplaine's father to death in his torture chamber, the king exacts a further revenge by ordering that the boy's face be carved into a permanent, hideous smile. Abandoned in the snowy hills, Gwynplaine rescues another outcast, a blind girl named Dea. The two join a circus troupe and grow up together. The adult Gwynplaine falls in love with the sightless Dea, who sees only his kindness and not his grotesquely smiling face. When his noble heritage is revealed, Gwynplaine is presented in court before the queen, who considers his permanent grin an insult. Once more an outcast, Gwynplaine sails to the new world with the loving Dea at his side. That's a very brief plot description, but a basic gist of what happens. Yeah, so here's the thing. I really like silent cinema, particularly silent horror, because there is a sense that you're almost watching like a completely different art form in a lot of ways than the movies we watch now. Those early silent movies are so completely unlike what we have now that you really have to kind of put yourself in a different headspace than you would if you were watching something that is made more in more modern times. Particularly like the 50s, 60s, and on, I think. There's a different rhythm to the storytelling. You see what happens acted out visually, and often very stylized, and then you see a dialogue card or something. And then you go back to the visual element for a while. And the whole time, music in the background plays, and that provides a different element as well. It can be a very unusual viewing experience for the modern viewer, and yeah, for me. I count myself among the modern viewers, just so you know. The issue that I personally run into, and I know that I'm probably not alone here, is that I'm so used to the rhythm and tropes of current cinema that it's hard for me to really lock in while watching silent films. I need to be alone with no possible distractions and really focus on the film. This is probably something that you should do for all movies, but whatever. It's also maybe best for me to see these type of movies in a theater or a theater-style atmosphere. I watched a lot of silent cinema in my college courses, for example, and that was a good atmosphere to kind of take them in. But movies in a theater, what a concept, I know. I also tend to like my silent movies in like the 60 to 75 minute range. And part of the reason I've put off watching The Man Who Laughs for so long, I've never actually watched it. I've watched clips of it, and I've read quite a bit about it. But I've never actually sat down and watched it beginning to end. And part of that reason is because it's like an hour and 50 minutes. It's an hour and 50 minutes silent film. And there are times when you can feel it. I'm not going to lie. I try really hard not to approach silent movies from a, is this bad or is this good angle? You really got to meet the films halfway. These types of films are so different and made so long ago that I don't really feel like I have the proper context to judge it in a good or bad way. Is The Man Who Laughs a good movie? Yes, sure, why not? Yeah, no, it's a great movie. The Man Who Laughs and other works of silent cinema are significant not because they are great movies, and I don't get me wrong, I think this is, and I know I'm being kind of flippant in that regard, but I think they're significant because they are important films. I know that it's not necessarily a horror movie, but the horror elements are there in the film sets, and the camera angles, and in the performance of Conrad Veidt. Here's Ebert again on the film, and I know I'm going back to him, but you really should read through his essay on the film when you get a chance. It's part of his great movies essay series. But here he is again. The Man Who Laughs is a melodrama, at times even a swashbuckler, but it's so steeped in expressionist gloom that it plays like a horror film. Everything centers on the extraordinary face of Gwynplaine, whose wide and mirthless grin inspired the Joker character in the original Batman comic books. Unlike the Joker and most villains who smile, however, he is a good and decent man, one so horribly aware of his disfigurement that he reveals it only on the stage as a way to earn a living. That good and decent man being disfigured is kind of something, it's kind of a trope, trend, whatever you want to call it, that we see in a lot of horror movies and works of horror. The film is more disturbing than it might have been because of Leni's mastery of visual style. In the haunted screen, her history of the German silent period, Lottie Eisner notes that expressionists often used unusually low ceilings and doorways in order to force their characters to walk stooped over sideways. That's kind of a look into the expressionist style that is used in The Man Who Laughs and a lot of 20s horror movies. There are a few other points outside of German expressionism that I want to touch on regarding The Man Who Laughs. The influence it had on the Joker has been written about pretty extensively, but yes, the visual appearance of the Joker was heavily influenced by Conrad Veidt and the makeup done by Jack Pierce. You can go take a look, just do a Google image search of The Man Who Laughs and you can see it. Den of Geek, I found, has a pretty in-depth write-up of this. Just Google The Man Who Laughs and Joker and you can find quite a few write-ups of this over at the site. It's pretty much Bill Finger and Bob Kane never made any bones about the fact that the design for the Joker was lifted pretty much directly from The Man Who Laughs. So feel free to do your own research on that. I think that's been talked about a lot. The time it was made, though, the 1920s was a time of major income disparity in the United States. By 1929, this was released in 27-28, by 1929, the top 0.1% had a combined income equal to the bottom 42% of the country. They also controlled 34% of savings, while 80% of Americans had no savings at all. This is from Prezi.com. So a film that focuses much of its plot on the relationship between those at the top and those at the bottom, and then also features a lower class individual trying to navigate the upper class, is an example of a film using certain elements of the time it was created during to kind of tell its story and maybe frighten the audience a little. But finally, the most interesting part of The Man Who Laughs for me personally is that for a short time, Leni was attached to Universal's Dracula with Conrad Veidt to star as Dracula. The following is from classichorror.com in an essay on Leni, The Forgotten Master. He was considered to be Universal's top horror specialist when rumors began to circulate that Universal had acquired the rights to Bram Stoker's Dracula, and Conrad Veidt was to be the film's star. Without a doubt, the restored partnership of Leni and Veidt, which had already been proven, would have indeed given us a Dracula produced on a far grander scale. Leni's last work had been an experimental short with synchronized sound titled Puzzles. Then Universal's Dracula was shelved for another year when Paul Leni prematurely passed away from blood poisoning caused by a neglected ulcerated tooth on September 2nd, 1929, at the age of 44. One of the other hangups, yeah, that's from classichorror.com. It goes over why Universal's Dracula was not made by Paul Leni. He passed away. Tough to direct as a ghost. One of the other hang-ups that kept this from happening, though, was centered around Veidt. Like a lot of silent film stars, Veidt was, like, he was terrified to make the jump to sound film, to the talkies. He feared that his skills wouldn't translate, and honestly, those fears weren't necessarily unfounded. Silent film acting required a completely different skill set in a lot of ways, and many people were not actually able to make that transition. Veidt eventually would, but I really think a Leni Veidt Dracula belongs on whatever list we are making of the greatest unmade horror movies. I'm not a huge fan of the Universal Dracula outside of Lugosi's performance. It's been said by a lot of people before, but I want to reiterate it because I'm in the same boat. The Spanish language Dracula, which you can find on a lot of the Dracula releases, the Spanish language Dracula, which was shot during the same time and using the same sets as the Lugosi film, is the superior movie. It's much more moody, much more atmospheric. If you were to somehow transfer Lugosi's performance and put it in the Spanish language version, I think you could have something really special. As it is, the original Universal Dracula movie I find quite dull. Most of it is incredibly stage-bound. It's kind of shot like a stage play, and it has these long, awkward stretches of silence in it. I don't really know the exact reason behind it. David Scall, in his book Monster Show, goes into some of the reasons. A lot of it wasn't even directed by director Todd Browning, it seems. Many have speculated that Browning's alcoholism may have played a role in it. I don't know. But I think a Lenny Veit version of the film would have been something completely different than what we got. A Universal Dracula film with heavy German expressionist influences really would have been something to see. The Frankenstein films, particularly Son, I think were the closest we ever got to something like that. But I would have loved to have seen someone with the physical talents of Veit take on the lead role. The movie may have been similar in a lot of ways to Murnau's Nosferatu, but I think Lenny's direction and his work within the studio system would have made it a bit more accessible in some ways. Either way, I think we would have gotten something a little more epic and definitely a little bit more atmospheric than Browning's movie, what we eventually got. So yeah, there we go. There is kind of just me talking about The Man Who Laughs for a little bit. I want to do some classic horror movies whenever I get the chance. I really, really love watching them and talking about them. So yeah, thank you everybody for listening. That's it for this week. I'm going to wrap it up. Make sure to check out our other podcasts on the Midwest Podcast Network. Make sure to check out our main show, Horror Movie Yearbook. We just covered The Brood by David Cronenberg. Make sure to check out The Game Nerds. They're talking about, I want to say Dead Cells, but you can head on over to MidwestGameNerds.com. Gone to Texas will be back next week. They had some travel issues. Both of them are out of town. One of them's out of the country, I believe. So, and check out, you can catch up on Preacher. Gone to Texas is the podcast. You can check out our Patreon, patreon.com/MidwestPodNet. You can donate to the podcast network for as little as $1 a month. But yeah, that's it for this week. I'm going to wrap it up. Next week, I'll be back. I'm going to talk about Castle Rock Monday. Kind of the same schedule. Castle Rock Monday, a new release Tuesday, maybe The Ranger. I'm thinking The Ranger. And then later in the week, I'm going to talk about Halloween 2 and Halloween 3. I'm going through my Halloween rewatch right now. And then I think next week, the classic movie I want to do is Vampyr, the 1932. We'll travel back then. But I want to talk about Vampyr a little bit. So that's it for this week. Once again, thank you everybody for listening. You can check out all of these horror hotlines at horrormovieyearbook.com if you are so inclined. But yeah, everybody, have a good weekend. I'll see you all back here on Monday. We'll talk a little Castle Rock. Bye now.